This episode of Inside Acting is brought to you in part by Rehearsal 2, the app for actors. Want to learn your lines fast, be off book for auditions, explore your characters and make stronger choices? There's an app for that, Rehearsal 2. Download it now at rehearsaltheapp.com/download. That's rehearsaltheapp.com/download.
Hello and welcome to episode 119 of Inside Acting. I'm AJ Meyer.
I'm Trevor Elgott.
And on this podcast, we interview writers, directors, agents, managers, casting directors, personal finance gurus, personal fitness gurus, filmmakers of all shapes and sizes and colors and creeds and other things that identify human beings. And we package it up into this little thing we call a podcast and put it on the internet. For you.
Yes, we do. And we're two guys that do it, and that doesn't make us any kind of more crazy knowledgeable or qualified, I guess, than anybody else, except that we've kind of worked a little bit in the industry and talked to a bunch of people. And so our goal is just to kind of figure out all the different kind of ways in that there are. So if you hear something on the show that you want to chime in on, feel free to do that. We definitely would love to hear from you. InsideActingPodcast.com is the best place to go to get started with that.
And on this episode, we have part two of our interview with Dennis Henry Hennelly. So stick around for that.
So, hey, everybody. How's it going, man?
It's going to be okay, brother. We're going to make it through.
We're going to make it through?
We're going to make... Hey, look, 45 right. minutes. 45 minutes, you can go take a nap.
All right. There we go.
Trev's feeling a little under the weather. Yeah. I was... I got sick twice. I had that thing that happens when you close a show. Mm. And your body's like, okay, we can shut down now because... Yeah. Like, it seems like all your cells go, a break? And you just disintegrate into a pile of snot. I got sick closing weekend ish and after, and then I got better, and then I was dealing with moving, and the lack of sleep ended up getting me sick again. Mm. I got sick back to back, and it was awful. And now you have the same bug that's going around because I've heard of other people who've had it too.
Yeah, it's kind of blech. I missed your show, man. I think I've only missed two shows that you've done in the history of our knowing each other, and I think this was the second one. I can't believe how quickly it started and stopped.
Yeah, it was only a 3-week run that they extended a week, plus it was like the hottest ticket in Los Angeles.
It was sold out well in advance. Yeah.
Yeah. I was saying this earlier. I know that this is not the end for this show. They got an overwhelmingly positive response from their, you know, Guthmans, their investors, their people that came to see it. It's going to have a life. It's just a matter of where, when, and how. I know it's going to have a life. So Trevor and I were talking about that before we started recording, but we'll see. Yeah. Obviously, I will keep everyone updated. And then, you know, the question is, depending on where it goes and how it goes and what happens, do I choose to go with it?
Yeah.
And that's a whole other conversation and choice and something that's, like I said, it's a discussion to be had.
Well, it sounds like the whole kind of reasons that you did it paid. I mean, you basically got paid the way you were looking to get paid. I mean, I remember you saying that you weren't getting paid financially, but you were on board for other reasons, and a lot of that was just kind of rubbing elbows and connecting with some of the right people, and it sounds like that happened, as well as a bunch of kind of awesome celebrities and sort of celebrities and mega celebrities came to see it.
Specifically on closing day. So on closing day, the mayor of Los Angeles, Darren Criss from Glee, Missy Pyle, Billy Crystal, and Winona Ryder all came to see the show.
Awesome.
So it was, yes, it was a plethora of, you know, A-list celebrities. It was really interesting. Billy didn't stick around, but he and his wife enjoyed the show. He is currently rehearsing 700 Sundays, which is his one-man show that he's taking to Broadway. I think he's just friends with Andy Fickman, the director, because I think Andy directed him in something.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wynonna stuck around, and we all got pictures with her and That's talked really cool. to her. And she loved it. She loved it a lot and was, like, crying, and she really enjoyed it.
And you may or may not have spoken to some of these people about possibly being guests on future episodes of the podcast.
Yeah, may or may not have. Yeah, I mean, you know, you and I, we had this, like, I don't know, mini breakthrough the other night at our masterminds meeting where we were thinking about how crazy it is that, like, we just naturally decided that our purpose was to share something of value with other actors in the community and kind of put it out there. And so I'm always thinking of, like, our listeners as well. You know, like, I've established my relationship with Andy Fickman for life. Like, we're going to be, you know, lifelong colleagues and friends. But I'm always thinking about the podcast and our listeners and creating value here. So of course I invited him on the show and he agreed. So he'll be coming on the show. Larry O'Keefe, who wrote Bad Boy and Legally Blonde and Heathers, is coming on the show. And Missy Pyle stuck around for a while and talked to all of us. She was friends with the lead in the show and I invited her on the show and she's coming on the show. So like I'm always, and I know you feel the same way too. And so does Jen. Jen does it all the time. Jen Levin, our production coordinator, you know, she's always out sort of beating the streets as it were. And if anybody she sees, you know, she thinks she could, you know, potentially add value to the podcast, she's inviting them on the show. So,
yeah. My week was, pretty, well, actually, well, I talked about this in episode 118. I had an audition meeting last Friday, which I talked about on last episode. So I was kind of like, just kind of dealing with not hearing back about that, which is, you know, we've talked about that a million times. There's a million reasons why I may not have heard back and you just got to let it go. And I took Emily Rose's advice from way back in like the 60s of our episodes. And I set up something really nice to do for myself right after the read. So I went out and I bought myself a really nice meal at Qdoba. It's like a Chipotle type place.
Oh, okay.
There's one right down here in the mall and, got an awesome burrito and just sat around and watched a movie afterwards. It was
nice.
Really nice. Yeah.
What
so it made the audition pleasant. I don't remember actually. I think I might've fallen asleep. It's one of these DVDs here, but, yeah, it was cool. And then, a web series that I shot probably like a year and a half ago just finally came out this past week. It's called Web Love. And it's really well done. I talked about this
on
a recent episode of the podcast. And my buddy Dan did it. I went to high school. I grew up with him. We played Little League soccer or, you know, kids soccer together and went to the same high school. And he went off to NYU. And that was this was the web series where I went over to his house and he had put the clips of all my lines back to back. So there were like 25 of them in a row. And he just mic'd me up and I would just say the lines over and over and over until we can have a bunch of different takes to put it in. So almost the entire episode of this is almost all the episodes are 80 yard. And if you're watching for it, if you're looking closely, you can tell, but it still sounds great. And he did such a good job with it. The writing is so clever and it's fun. And he's released the first three episodes already. And then he's going to do one more a week, I think for the next 5 weeks. And it's really great. You know, at the start of every episode, it's a little previously on Web Love and it does a little recap and it's really well done, man. And you got to see, I want our listeners to go watch episode one. I have nothing to do with the series except for being in episode three, but episode one is what I talked about a while ago where he basically just guerrilla style shot this episode. Like he brought his camera into like a male strip club and he brought it like out on the Hollywood Boulevard and like he just shot wherever he freaking wanted to. And it makes it look like it is the highest production value thing ever. And he just like basically did it and waited for somebody to tell him to stop filming. And when I talked to him about it, he's like, either people wanted to get in the shot and like be in it, or they waited for me to finish and then asked me if I was done. He's like, I had never had anybody tell me to just turn off the camera and try and take the footage or anything. So if you watch episode one, you'll be like, how the hell did he get this nightclub with all these dancers. Like, all those people are just in it, whether they like it or not.
Oh, my God.
he didn't film their faces, so, you know, it's like, it's legit, you know, it's not like he's breaking any rules, but it's cool. It's really cool. It's really inspiring, and it's just a really
I'd recognize those abs anywhere.
If that's what you're looking at, you're in good shape.
Literally, good shape. Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. That reminds me of, I've told this story on the podcast before, but Ed Burns, when he shot, what is it, the Brothers McMullen?
Mm-hmm. like all of his movies, almost.
He went out onto, like, Broadway. Like, he was, like, literally in Times Square in New York. And people were like, how the hell did you get these shots? They're amazing. They're so beautiful. He literally took a telephoto lens and stuck it on something like a DSLR camera and put lav mics on his actors. And they were, like, way, way down. Like, he was saying, like, it must have been, like, half a mile, just an insanely far distance away, walking towards the camera, having a conversation with one another. And he would shoot them from, you know, way down the block, but pointing up the street. And they would do a few takes, and what you end up having at the end of it all is, you know, the life of New York with all the people walking around in the cars and everything like that with the scene going on. And people are always like, oh my God, how did you do this? And it's the same thing. It's just total guerrilla style. So kudos to your friend, Dan.
Yeah, it's like, cool. With that situation though, with Ed Burns, I wonder if people's faces are in the shot, like how much you can use that kind of thing.
I don't know.
That may be something to explore.
Once we finally get his butt on the podcast, we can ask him ourselves.
Yeah.
But I remember him telling that story when he came and did that thing at the Apple Store when he worked there.
Yeah.
Years ago. But I saw the episode you were in. I admittedly have not seen any of the other episodes, but I saw the one that you were in. It's really funny. Like, it's sort of uncomfortably funny in that, like, meet the parents type way where you're just like, this is, I'm laughing, but I'm really uncomfortable. But it was really funny. And your part was ridiculous. If you want an opportunity to laugh at Trevor, you should watch this episode.
Cause it's super douchey, man.
Douchey doesn't even begin.
He had to like really coach me to like, be more of a dick. And then actually when we did the ADR stuff, he was telling me, he was like, actually the audio that we got was not too bad, but like, you're too nice in it still. So like, be super dickish with this audio.
Oh
so,
my God. That's hilarious.
It was a little bit of a stretch, but it was fun, man.
Any update on that, that short film you did?
Oh,
it's going to be a while, huh?
I think he said mid-December was when he was looking to have a
I remember you saying something like that, yeah.
So I can't wait. You know, there's a bunch of pictures on Facebook. There's a bunch of, there's a page you can go like on Facebook and kind of keep up to date with it. But
you should put that link on our website.
Yeah, sure.
So people can go like the page.
People should check it out, yeah.
Because I would like to like it.
I would like it if you liked it.
I would like to like it, but you're not... liking, you're not like putting it on the website.
I was waiting for you to bust a like in there. So we don't really have any emails or voicemails to specifically kind of play on this episode.
No questions per se.
We did get a warm fuzzy email to end all warm fuzzy emails from a listener named Matt that was just like. I mean, I think if you get one of these in your entire life, you're a very blessed person. And it was really...
I'm going to print it up and it'll be like my ticket to heaven.
Yeah.
Show up at the pearly gates and be like, this is what I did while I was down there. Thank you very much.
Yeah. It felt really good to just get that kind of acknowledgement. You know, it makes it all worth it.
Matt, Trevor is talking about framing it. So
it really meant a lot. So thank you, Matt, for taking the time to not only listen to all the episodes, but then to let us know how... it has informed your journey, and then to take the time to write a pretty lengthy letter letting us know about all of it. I mean, everything. It was really great. And he also included a couple of picks of the week that we're going to be able to share over the next few episodes. And it was just cool. And he's in New York, so he's not even in LA. Mm-hmm. So that just kind of goes to show, too, that some of the things we're talking about here, you know, because you and I are stationed here, so... it's easy to
stationed.
It's easy to be in the bubble and just kind of assume that things work this way everywhere. So it was good to get that kind of validation that in New York, this stuff flies. Everything we've been learning and then of course, espousing, it flies over there as well, you know?
Yes.
It's really good to hear.
Absolutely. Because we're always wondering, too. Like, we're always like, does this apply? Or we'll, like, preface it by saying, well, in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
When you said station, though, my mind went all kinds of places. What branch of the military are you in? Yeah. Acting?
Yeah, right. You know what?
We're in the trenches. What other military terms are used in the entertainment industry? In the trenches?
Fighting the good fight? I don't know. Pounding the pavement? I mean...
Wait, yeah.
Oh, sniper rifle versus shotgun. That's a good one.
Trevor! I love it.
Soldiers of art. I love it.
The War of Art.
Yeah, yeah.
There it is.
I also wanted to take a minute just to talk about this cool workshop that we just did. Listener invited us to...
Dana,
who's a patron of the podcast and has been a long-time listener, invited us to a workshop by a guy named Tim Phillips, who has an interesting approach to acting. And we were talking in the car just about the kind of psychology approach that he has, and I really got a few things out of it. I really enjoyed what he had to say. Anything that you wanted to kind of share on this afternoon? We spent 3 hours in a workshop with this.
I had a couple of guy. Like noodle baker moments. You know, it was fascinating. He was one of the things that really stuck out to me, and I thought this would appeal to you too because of like your how much you enjoy like Ishmael and that kind of like the sort of like history of humanity. That's what it's called, right?
Ishmael.
What's his name?
Daniel Quinn.
Yeah. Just you're sort of fascinated with like the history of humanity and the future of humanity and like sort of like that arc. And he was talking about how as human beings, we have always told stories and remembered things through pictures.
That was a big one for me too.
You know, cause he was like talking about, I mean, he didn't necessarily mention this specifically, but what came up for me was like hieroglyphics. Like we've told story, we used to tell stories through pictures on cave walls, and there was like an oral tradition where people would pass it down from generation to generation by telling a story. And one of the things that I discovered just in sort of thinking about things a couple of years ago is that we can't remember anything without there being a sensory attachment to it. So like you literally can't remember anything unless you remember a smell, taste, touch, sight, or hearing. You know, if one of the five senses is not attached to it, you might know it by rote, but you can't really remember it. And so he was playing on the fact that so many actors are focused on getting off book and doing so with the words, meaning they study the words as opposed to the pictures. Mm. What's happening in the scene? What happened before? What's happening? you know, what was this person's life like? Like things like that. And then building it in pictures. And I thought that was, you know, because your question was very specific about the sort of human psychology of it all. And that was one of the things regarding human psychology that really stuck out for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I would add a sixth sense to that too. And I would say emotion. Like how many times have we imagined something with a thick, heavy, powerful emotion? I was kind of trying to find the right word there. But how many times have we imagined it? And then it becomes imprinted in our brains because it was so emotionalized, you know?
Yeah.
But it was cool because what that really brought up for me was when I was in high school and I was just learning about acting and learning all this stuff. And I did a play, a one act play called Indian Wants the Bronx. And it's a really cool play if you've never read it or seen it or anything. But there were a lot of lines, and I asked my acting teacher, her name's Marianne Carlson Morgan over at Radnor High School. I think she's still there. She was a really wonderful woman. And I asked her, how do I memorize all this stuff? Like, I don't know how to memorize these lines. There's like, you know, 4,000 words here I have to memorize. And she said, don't memorize the lines, memorize the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, like that was a big, that was like a big level up in my experience of what acting is. Mm-hmm. It was just like, oh, I don't have to be so technical and just get all mechanical about reciting these things. I memorized the ideas, and of course from there it leads to the emotions, which leads to the story arc and the intention, and then what role my character fits in the whole arc of the thing. It was just awesome. And when he talked about that today, he talked about, you know, memorizing pictures or remembering pictures and really taking the time to use your imagination to fill in the imagery of your character. I thought right back to Mrs. Morgan's advice, memorize ideas, yeah, not lines.
Yeah.
And then the lines just come if you've got the idea.
Yeah. And so he has a very specific approach to scene work, and it's specifically for auditions because, you know, what he was talking about was, look, if you get a set of sides and it's 2 to 3 pages or 3 to 4 pages of what is, you know, probably like if it's a episodic, you know, it could be like a 50 page script or something like that. You know, you don't have much to go on. So step one is, what he calls, you know, Sherlock Holmesing the script, just being, he was all about being a good detective. And there was some very interesting, specific technical stuff. We were looking at the first page of this thing from CSI New York, and it was, you know, number 303. And he was like, all right, what do you know about this? Or what do you know about CSI New York? And, you know, we were like, oh, it's season 3, episode 3. And then I said it was episodic. And he said, episodic's great. He's like, you're not wrong, but it's not necessarily helpful because, what did he say? Episodic is business, mm-hmm. not human.
Yeah. Yeah.
Homicide is human. He said, no one's ever died by being episodic'd. And I was like, oh, got it. So mining the script for things that are actually useful as a human being, because that is what you will be playing. And then the second step is using that information to build your character, build your emotional life, so that you are nothing but authentic in the in the audition.
Yeah,
and interesting.
The actress that he was doing it with on stage, I don't know if you noticed, but she started getting pretty emotional when they were talking back and forth, and all he was doing was asking her questions, and she was basically making stuff up, like, tell me about what this room looks like, tell me about you know, how your parents were when you were growing up, like that kind of thing. And she just made stuff up, but she got really attached to it. And I remember him stopping her and saying, guys, she's lying right now, but do you believe her? We're all like, yeah. He's like, that's how easy it is. And then when he started kind of coaching her through like how to make the connections rather than making the emotion placed in the father, maybe it goes to the character in the script, which in this case was her brother. And then she started getting really emotional. I was like, wow, he just connected the dots in a really tangible way for me.
Yep.
It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And he even said to the other guy who was playing like the detective in the show, you know, there was a stage direction that said something along the lines of, he doesn't believe she could be a killer. He's like, what's the easiest thing you could do, you know, to like look at somebody and believe they're not a killer? It's like, turn them into your mom, your sister, your brother, like a family member. Like, oh, and so then all of a sudden, you know, maybe there's a look of like, whatever, pity or something on your face, but you can't play. How could you possibly play, oh, she doesn't look like a killer to me, like you're going to like strokey beard or something like that on camera?
Twirl your mustache.
And all that stuff he was saying about, you know, the camera does not, that's the quote. I saw you write this down, so I know this landed for both of us. One of the quotes that landed for both of us is, the camera does not pick up on acting. Like, it does not see you acting. It sees you having knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, it sees you being, it sees you living.
Yeah. And then he said, yeah. And then what he said, I think right before or after that, was knowledge, can only be experienced. Like you can only gain knowledge from experience.
It's not an intellectual thing, intellectual process,
which was great for me. 'Cause I'm the kind of person that loves to read books and then be like, I know this, you know, but it's like, well, have you applied it, Trev? Have you gone out and lived it? Have you actually taken the physical actions in the real world that you need to put it to the test and see what it feels like in your body. But to hear it put in acting terms that way was kind of an aha for me as well. So
awesome.
Yeah, it was really good stuff. So perhaps we'll be speaking more about this in future episodes. But for now, let's jump into let's jump into our chat with Dennis. This is part two of our chat with I keep wanting to say actor filmmaker. I'm just so used to putting that those two words together, but activist filmmaker Dennis Henry Henley. More of the same goodness from part one and part two here. So enjoy this, guys, and we'll catch you on the other side. This is a great segue to talk a little bit about what you kind of coined as activist filmmaking. I guess that's really the best way to put it, because this is a cause I imagine that's pretty near and dear to your heart, because this is, you wrote the script, and I remember I was telling you before we started recording that, or no, I did, where were we recording? I said this earlier, but I was saying that you know, I hadn't thought much about the implications of my food choices and where it came from and how the animals were treated and things like that. I hadn't thought about really any of that stuff. I was just kind of blissfully ignorant. And this audition process and reading the script opened my eyes to that. And it really kind of was kind of like a landslide from there for me to kind of just fall into this world and really start to understand a lot more about this. So from my experience, it was very impactful. I imagine that's kind of what your aim was, is to kind of get this out there. And it's cool because there are two different ways, I think, to affect people. You can stand up and give a lecture, or you can make a piece of art about it that people will interpret as they will. And, you know, they're both kind of equally powerful, but it depends on the kind of how the person consuming the information learns best, I suppose. So I guess my question is, what was it like to put this in a narrative form, and then why do that? Why not put together some sort of talk that you could then take around to schools or, you know, organizations of some kind or something like that?
Well, I'm interested in narrative filmmaking. It's what I've always wanted to do. And so when we were thinking about what do we want to try to make our first movie about, it was like, what do I care about? I care about this issue. I care about animal rights, and I care about the Animal Liberation Front. And these are people who I consider to be heroes. They go out there and they risk their freedom, because if the government catches you, this shit's considered terrorism in this country. Taking a puppy out of a lab so it doesn't get, like, chemicals shoved down its throat until it dies. Like, that's a terrorist act, to take the puppy away from that scene of abuse. That's fucking crazy. So for me, like, I wanted to make a film that talked about this issue. There was a couple different layers of it for me. Like, I knew at a certain point that most of the people who saw this movie were already going to have some interest in animal rights because of the way we were making it, which was very guerrilla. It wasn't going to, like, get distributed. People weren't going to walk into their local Cineplex and be like, oh my God, I wasn't expecting this movie that I just saw.
Right.
And so one thing that we wanted to talk about, two people who cared about this issue already, but may look at people who do these sort of things, like burn down a slaughterhouse or take animals out of places of abuse, and had heard that it's terrorism from the government, because the government and news sources want to keep saying this is terrorism, this is terrorism, this is terrorism. And a lot of people that cared about this issue were, like, on board with that, or would talk about things like this is violence. The favorite thing that people who are opposed to this kind of, like, illegal direct action for animals do is call it violence, which is a complete perversion of the term from our point of view. We were like, all right, violence is the exertion of force to injure or abuse. And does that, you know, is burning down a building violence? Can you injure or abuse a building? No. Obviously, you can injure and abuse a person. If a person's in that building, that would be injuring them, but nobody, that's never happened. This group is very explicit that they can never harm any animal, human or non-human, and they never have. And so, you know, one thing we wanted to talk about to people who cared about the issue but might look at some of these things as extreme actions is to say, hey, you should support this. If you support the idea that animals' interests should be respected by human beings, that we should look at other non-human animals and say, you have a right to your life. It's different than mine. You don't need the same things I do, but I'm going to consider your interests and give them weight. That in order to make that happen, we need something more than petitions. We need something more than good intentions. We need something more than people going vegan. Like, We need people who are taking direct action to take animals out of places of abuse and to do something that can strike at the underpinnings of exploitation. Mm. You know, no social change has ever happened in the world without some sort of attack on the economic structure that benefits from the exploitation that's being protested. You know, you can't, like, dismantle a system of exploitation without going after the economics of it. And so just attacking the idea that this sort of thing was violence was a big part of it for us. So you watch a movie and you're like, okay, I may not agree that that's the best tactic. I don't think it helps the cause because it turns people off or whatever, but it's not violence. You know, and so we wanted to defang that word. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that we were wanting to do. That's like the narrowest definition. The broadest is, hey, maybe somebody does stumble upon this because somebody hands them the DVD. Or they come with their friend to see the movie at one of the screenings we did. We self-distributed it and did like sold-out screenings around the country. Like where like awesome. Hundreds of people would come and, you know, it was events everywhere. We would have speakers there and like it would be, you know, Russell Simmons was presented the one in New York. Wow. And so somebody might come with a friend to something like that and be hit with this in the way that you were when you read the script and be like, I've never thought about this. And it's not a coincidence that you never think about it because the fact is there are millions and billions of dollars and a whole weight of capitalist society leaning on you to get you to not think about this issue.
Yeah.
Every single fucking thing you look at in the world wants you to not think about this issue because the fact is the animal rights philosophy is not an anathema. It's not opposed to what most people believe. It is, in fact, very much in line with our core principles as Americans, as human beings. Like, we believe that you should not hurt others. Most people believe you should not abuse animals. You know, most people care about animals because they're basically like children. You know, they are somewhat dependent on us. They're somewhat, you know, they are members of our earth. You know, there are other earthlings like us, and most of us care about them. And so the vast majority of people don't need to be, like, convinced that animals have worth and that we shouldn't abuse them. We're taught to turn a blind eye to certain kinds of abuse when there's products that we want or products that can be sold to us. And that's a culturally determined thing, you know, like dogs are eaten in lots of places in this world. We think it's bad if you kill a dog for food. If I, you know, there's a dog in this room with us right now. If I was like, hey, I'm going to chop this thing up and put it on the barbecue. You guys want some? Probably you wouldn't. I don't know. Most people wouldn't. If I was like, hey, I got some pork in the fridge. I'm going to make some pork chops. You'd be like, okay, yeah, I'm down with that. Because we distance ourselves from the actual animal. We call it pork instead of pig. We call it beef instead of cow. We do all these sort of things. This is all intentional, and it's marketed to us as products as opposed to beings, as opposed to, like, living entities that, you know, we all – the other thing that's interesting is, like, we also don't have to sell – like, there's this idea that, oh, it's so extreme that somebody might burn down a slaughterhouse in order to stop people from killing animals in it. Like, that's extreme. The fact is that we don't actually think that's extreme as human beings, like as Americans. We don't have a problem with that tactic. We use it all the time across the world. We blow shit up everywhere. It's a question of what you're doing it for. So it's not the tactic that's extreme. It's the recipient of the tactic, which in this case is non-human animals. And we're like, yeah, but why would you do it for a cow? Well, what's different between a cow and you? And that really is kind of the essential question, right? What is that difference? There's undoubtedly differences, but there is a moral, there's a philosophical moral principle that differences in rights should run parallel to differences in being. You know, like just because something's different than you, yes, they should have different rights. But those rights should reflect the differences in being. They shouldn't be completely arbitrary. Like, okay. You know, that cow doesn't want to drive a car, so we should be able to eat her. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It's like, that cow doesn't want to drive a car, so she shouldn't get a driver's license. You know what I mean? What is it that's different between us and non-human animals that gives us absolute power over them?
Yeah.
That's kind of the question. The answers generally go to one of two things, like we have a soul and they don't. That soul could be a religious soul, or it could be like a scientific soul, like reason. We reason and they don't. We this and they don't. We do something that they don't. And because of that, we can exercise power over them. Mm. Or it's a simple might makes right argument. It's like, we do it because we can. You know what I mean? We're stronger.
Yeah.
Honestly, both of those rationales civilized society has rejected in almost every other circumstance. It's like, yeah. if you pull out the, well, I did it because I could, because I'm tougher and stronger.
You made him American.
You know, most of us are going to be like, that's not really an acceptable reason to have killed that 80-year-old grandfather walking through the parking lot. You know,
right.
Don't really buy that. Or, yeah, well, I couldn't understand what that dude was saying. He was talking in Portuguese.
Yeah.
So I just kind of assumed he didn't have a soul. You know what I mean? Like, just because you can't understand what they're saying doesn't mean there's nothing going on in there.
Yeah. One of the things I was told as a kid, I remember as a kid I used to have a problem. When I figured out that my hamburger came from an actual animal and they had to kill the animal, I remember asking, why do we do this? Like, I can eat, you know, vegetables, like there's other things I can eat. And the answer that came back was because God put them here for men to rule over them. And then I started to really think about that. I was 10 years old, and I started to really think about what that meant as a world view. And I was like, so this whole planet was just put here for us to kind of conquer and rule? I was like, that doesn't seem right. I mean, we're just another animal, aren't we? And I started to really kind of put the pieces together, but at some point it just became too much work.
It's a lot of work because the society is based around, and trust me, I don't mean to sound self-righteous. Like, I'm holding an iPhone in my hand. This shit hurts somebody. Like, This is a product of near slave labor. I drive a car. People are killed and bombed and raped to get oil for that car. Like, we all do things that, like, have terrible consequences around the world. So I'm not saying that people who are vegan are, like, better than people who aren't. It's just something seems easy to me. And I understand it doesn't seem easy to other people. Mm. For me, it's like you should try to, like, exhibit as much compassion as you can. Try to be, you know, as small, like, don't be an asshole as much as possible. And to me, like, that's something that, like, is super easy, is just not using animals. Uh-huh. Other people might find it really hard and be like, why are you using a car? Ride a bike, you know?
Right.
Stop being such a dick. And so,
asshole, you're driving a hybrid.
I get it. Yeah. It's all like a continuum. I do just think it's really important, like you're saying, though, to try to be as conscious as possible, and honestly to, like, just ask yourself questions, like, why do you think one thing's okay when some other thing isn't?
Yeah,
that's exactly what I was just going to follow that up with, is that it really is just about awareness. I mean, hopefully some action comes from that awareness, and then you're not just like, oh yeah, hamburger. but you know, awareness and consciousness is so important, because then it you're at least informed, and you can make, you know, what Trevor you were saying either earlier or before recording, I can't remember either, about just making conscious, you know, choices. Because the thing that I'm always aware of here in the United States specifically is that we vote with our wallet, not with a ballot, you know? And so, when I became a vegetarian, it was for that reason. It was like, it had nothing to do with, you know, not wanting to, you know, it wasn't health based. It wasn't anything like, it was purely like a political protest, like a social thing, where I was like, I'm just not going to give my money to these things. And over time, I've sort of slowly moved back into, like Trevor and I know both, sort of omnivore, but, you know, pretty much 80% raw vegan. Now it's like, I do not eat meat if I don't know where it came from, if I don't know how the animals were treated, if I don't know, what kind it is. Like, it has to be, like, extremely vetted, and it's usually never red meat or anything. But it's really just about an awareness. It's about a consciousness. And I think that sort of brings us back to what you're doing in activist filmmaking or whatever, is that what you're doing with that work and with the documentaries that you've done and stuff is bringing awareness, because, you know, how there's only so many ways to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I approached like the, with Bold Native, I approached it sort of like the Fountainhead. I like Ayn Rand a lot. I know a lot of people don't like her. But that book taught me what it was to be an artist, you know, beyond like any of her capitalist, whatever. Like, for me, it was about art, the Fountainhead. And I loved the way that she embodied philosophical ideas and characters and then put them in conflict. Because philosophical ideas in conflict is what the world is about. We carry around things that we believe, whatever they are, and those things crash up against each other. And that's really interesting. And so with her stuff, she makes it really solid archetypal things. It could be more subtle, you know. In every film, characters carry around these things they believe, and you see those things come into conflict. And that teaches us about life. That is philosophy. Like, all films, unless they're completely vapid and mindless, and there certainly are plenty of those, are it's activist filmmaking of some sort. It's one person's point of view about the world, whether it's a tragedy, and the person who believes this bites it in the end, or the person who believes that wins in the end. Like, that is saying something about the way the world is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you're conscious of that, you, I think, have some power. If you're not, you're going to put messages out into the world that could be harmful, could be helpful, you don't know. Like, but people learn how to live from movies. They just do. You know what I mean? And like, so all your filmmaking is going to be activist in some sense. Sometimes you are conscious of that, and sometimes you aren't. With Bold Native, we were like, this character represents the idea that you can use violence to change the world. This character represents the idea that you can't use violence, but you can break the law. This character represents the idea that you have to work within the system. Go about and do your shit, and let's see what happens.
And let's
see
who wins. Yeah.
And like, that's straight out like philosophical narrative, which is classically what all storytelling is about. Like, here's how, what's the best way to live life? That's what philosophy is. It's how do you live life well? And like, that's what movies are about too. I mean, I just watched both of Derek, I don't know how to say his last name, Cianfrance, Blue Valentine and Place Beyond the Pines.
Yeah.
Like, those movies are both about like, how do you live well?
Yeah.
Those are philosophical activist films about like life, how to be a father, how to be in love, like, and you, if you don't come away with from those movies with like, and treat people around you better after watching them, you haven't watched them.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, as I've been doing more writing myself, I've come to understand all art, but especially narrative filmmaking, is really just thesis statements about our culture and what we want to examine, whether, and sometimes it's not necessarily about how to live life well, but it, like you said, it's a tragedy, and it's, here's how to not live life, you know, and let me show you how awful it could be, you know, sometimes.
Which, as an audience, you should come away knowing how to live life well.
Right, right.
Don't do what that asshole
did.
Look
at the other side of the coin. And that leads me to another question. With Bold Native and with some of the documentaries and things like that that you've produced or created or written or just been involved with, were you ever worried that you might just be preaching to the choir?
Yeah.
Because I think of movies like Earthlings, and I'm like, I don't know anybody who wants to see that movie.
Yeah, Earthlings, though it has made a lot of people think about, if you haven't seen Earthlings yet, anyone who's listening, do it right away. It's called Earthlings, and you can watch it for free online as well. Yeah.
Just for listeners who aren't aware, it's a documentary about the food system, and Joaquin Phoenix narrates it, and it's very graphic.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you're gonna eat it, you should watch where it came from.
Yeah, I agree.
That's the thing. It's like, people are like, oh, I don't want to see that. It's like, well, somebody else has to live that.
Yeah,
you know, that's an entity that has to live that, and you should at least watch it once in your life. If you can watch it and be like, yeah, fuck those animals, then fine. You know what
Jeez.
I mean?
Yeah.
I guess that's where you're coming from. But to me, like, you have the responsibility of knowledge. You have the responsibility to know what the consequences of your actions are.
Right.
Do what you want with that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But like, at least that I can feel pretty confident not being an asshole saying like, you have that responsibility.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I mean, there was a point with Bold Native where it was because, like, where it was like, we're doing this in such a guerrilla style that, like, and we're going to self-distribute it. Like, we submitted to film festivals, and I swear to God, like, our previous documentary, Rock the Bells, had played Tribeca Film Festival. We'd played, like, we played festivals all around the world. We opened at Tribeca and then spent a year, like, going to tons of festivals. And at every festival I went to, I watched a ton of narrative movies. And I was like, I know our movie is as good as 50% of the movies I saw at these big festivals. I know we'll get in. It's provocative. It's like, this is a movie that's like, hey, you know, yay terrorism. You know what I mean? It's like, because terrorism, this isn't terrorism, I don't think. You know what I mean? Like, it was a, it's a kind of movie that you expect to see at a film festival, right? It's like provocative and interesting, and it's well done, and it moves, and like, and we didn't get in to the first three we submitted to. And I was like, what the hell is going on? And I don't know if it was like, it's too provocative. It's like, people want to be provoked, but they don't want their own lifestyle provoked, maybe. Or they feel uncomfortable that, like, they're sponsors of the festival, and they're like, this might be, you know, we have, you know, Smithfield Farms or whatever, like, sponsoring. We don't want to rock that boat. Or maybe they just thought the movie sucked. I don't know. I've programmed too. I know, like, you can't really understand why shit doesn't get in. But after three rejections, I was like, forget it. We're just going to self-distribute it. Hmm. And we used Facebook, and we basically just, like, because I kind of figured, like, let's, I know there's a lot of people who want to see this movie. There's never been a fiction film about this subject. There's never been, like, a real straight-out animal rights fiction film. And there's people who want to see it. Like, let's get it out there. And if they all go see it, we'll get it into theaters, and maybe other people will hear about it. And it will sort of, like, let's use our base to, like, get it into the consciousness, and then hopefully it expands. I don't know if that happened at all. Like, I don't know beyond the base how many people saw it. I know some. Because I do hear from people who are like, I never thought about this till I saw it. I feel differently. Either I went vegan, or I think about it more, or whatever. Like, somehow it has this impact. But it certainly was not what we intended when we started the idea. We wanted it to be seen by mainstream audiences, you know? That was not the path we ended up taking with it. I don't know if it had that path. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I know that, like, there's people now that are working on an adaptation of a book that Ingrid Newkirk wrote about the Animal Liberation Front, and they're trying to get it done in, like, a big way, and maybe they will. But what sort of compromises will happen along that path? Like, how watered down will it become? We were talking before we started recording about The East, which is kind of about a similar type group that deals with environmental issues, but they do use violence against people. I don't know how well that movie did. Not very well, I don't think. I mean,
I don't think it wasn't projected to do well because it was a smaller indie film type thing anyway.
But how many people went to see it that aren't already kind of, like, on board with the idea that, like,
exactly,
you know,
yeah,
somebody needs to do something about the environment? We're losing this battle against the forces that are destroying our environment. We need some solid, direct action to happen now. People who already think that that's an issue to be concerned about, I don't think that's what the film says. It's like, it asks questions more than has a statement, which is what we do when we make films sometimes. We like, I like films that make a statement more than, like, just sort of bring up an issue. But I do think, like, that, who's going to go see it other than people who already are interested in it? That's right, kind of the thing that right. You get. And it's like, we are working on a documentary right now. We've been cutting it for like 3 years. It is about a court case about a group of people who ran a protest campaign against an animal testing laboratory called HLS. And they wrote a campaign called SHAC, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. It was all above ground. They organized protests. They gave speeches at college campuses. There were some incidents of vandalism that happened during the campaign against targets. These people were never accused of doing that. They were simply accused of talking. The campaign was very smart and very aggressive. Instead of going to the lab and protesting at the building and holding signs, they chose companies that did business with the lab. So they would choose the bank that gave the lab a loan. They would choose the insurance company that insured the lab.
Wow.
And they would go to the homes of the people who own those companies and say, your company is insuring a company that kills 500 animals a day, including beagle puppies, by shoving chemicals down their throat until they die. And I'm going to hold a sign of one of those beagle puppies in front of your house so your neighbors can see what you're insuring.
Wow.
It was a simple name and shame campaign. What they did was legal. Home protest is legal. But these companies were like, is it worth it? And these people were relentless. They spent a year protesting a company that gave a loan to this lab. And this company at the beginning was like, we'll never back down. Screw those people. After a year of having people like hold signs in front of their house, you know, and like they were like, you know what? It's not worth it. How much money are we making off this one company? We extend our services to thousands. It's not worth it.
Wow.
And it was so effective. It was sort of how they took down apartheid. They did a similar like tertiary targeting. They went after like banks and companies that dealt with the apartheid government in South Africa and said, don't deal with them or we're going to protest you. We're going to hold you accountable for the companies you do business with. And it was super effective. And the government held hearings on it, where like James Inhofe sat on the floor of the Senate and asked the FBI director from California, why aren't these kids in jail? The FBI person is saying, they're not breaking the law. I can't put them in jail. They wrote a law, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, that basically was an extension of a previous law saying, like, if you do this, if you cause economic damage to a company whose business is animal enterprise, animal exploitation, that's terrorism. So because these people were being so effective, you know, HLS could come and say, they've cost us $1 million. They've cost us $40 million. That was terrorism. And these six activists who had done nothing more than speak, they weren't accused of doing anything more than talking positively about this campaign, got between 1 to 6 years in federal prison.
Jeez.
For this campaign.
Wow.
And this law will get extended to other activist campaigns. And that's what James Inhofe said on the floor, at the hearings. He was like, there will be the military industrial complex version of this. There will be the agriculture version of this. And you start to see it happening with Monsanto and companies like this.
Yeah,
people are
yeah.
becoming more active in their campaign. And there's now the Monsanto protection law that was passed. Like, this is the way it's going, right? And so that film is about that subject. And it's like, the question is always like, how do you get people who don't already care about it to see it?
Right, exactly.
You know, like, and so it's tough. I don't have a good answer other than I think in a way you kind of don't. You just make sure that you make something that has meaning to the people who will see it, who are already the audience. They just because they know about the issue doesn't mean that there's nothing to say to them about it.
Mm-hmm.
Say to them, hey, you know about this. You care about this. You're taking 2 hours of your life to watch this movie. Let me push you farther down that path. Let me radicalize you more. Let me give you another tactic. Let me say to you, hey, that thing that you think that you're doing that's making a difference in the world, maybe it's not. Maybe the fact that nobody's coming after you means that what you're doing is kind of bullshit. Here's some people who were doing something, and look what happened to them. So, and when this happened to them, did anybody stand up for them? No. So, this is happening now. Look around. See it happening again. Stand up this time. Mm-hmm. You know, what can you do? What can you say to people when you know that you're preaching to the choir, you know,
right.
in quotes? Like, the choir still needs to hear something, you know? Activate the choir. You know what I mean? The choir can do something.
That's true.
There's like this, there's this study about, I forget what it was called, where like they, you know, it's the shock study, where basically they gave people, they said, you know, give that person a shock in the next room. And they had an actor in the next room and they pretended that they got an electric shock. And they said, this shock, you know, we're going to keep turning it up. And now we've turned it up high enough that when you press this button, it will kill that person. And like 76% of people, because an authority figure in a laboratory told them, it's okay, we want you to press that button. It will kill them, but we want you to do it. 76% of people fucking press the button.
Wow.
And so what you're saying is like only 24% of people or whatever, it's something like that, is somewhere in the 20s, said no. Those are the people that think for themselves in this world. And those are the people that are going to see your documentary or your film that's about something. Like, tell them something. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Because everybody else is just going to go along with what those people say. You know, you may be speaking to minority, but the vast majority of people will go along because they really just want to enjoy life.
Well, you know what's so interesting about that is that roughly you're talking about the 80-20 rule, and that 80% of your results are going to come from 20% of your efforts. And so, bam, there's the 20% that you need to create the 80% of the results.
It's a tipping point. It's like that Malcolm Gladwell book.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't need to change everybody's mind.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, I think, yeah, preach to the choir, but, like, give them something, get them riled up.
Yeah, you solidified it when you said activate the choir. I thought, oh, well, of course. Like, these people who are going to their friends and they're demonstrating their belief by their way of living and their way of being, rather than pushing books and seminars and classes and things like that in front of people, they now have another tool. And it just might be that one thing that person's like, I'm sick of the books, I'm sick of this, I'm sick of that, like, just stop. And they say, well, here's a cool movie. And be like, oh, well, actually, that sounds kind of compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the one thing that it gets through and then, you know, can, I hate to use this word, but it's the only one that's coming to my brain, convert, you know, somebody from a non-believer into a believer, as it were. I know that's a really bad way to put it, but you know what I mean? Enroll somebody in your point of view.
Yeah.
Or at least get them to consider the possibility of what it might be like if they were to try it. That's powerful. So we are just about out of time, but we have two questions we'd like to wrap up all our guests with. And the first one is, they're both a little bit out there, but we love them because we always get really fascinating answers from our guests. And so the first one is, do you feel like this career path, and I guess when you've done so much that I'm thinking more specifically about narrative filmmaking, do you think that this career path chose you, or do you feel like you chose it?
It chose me. This was not like what I was planning on doing with my life, but Dale Cooper entered my life, Agent Cooper, and like Twin Peaks and the whole David Lynch world, and I was just like, it felt like my life. Like, I grew up in a small town. I felt like lonely and alienated, and like I didn't fit in, and I felt like there was always something like under the surface, and like David Lynch movies were like, that's it. That's what the world is like. That makes sense to me, finally. And the fact that like a movie could do that just made me fall in love with the medium, and I was like, wow, this is great. I want to do that with my life.
That's awesome. And then our second question,
if you could take all of your experience, everything that you've learned through, I guess, your years in filmmaking, working in production offices, directing documentaries, directing narrative film, writing, if you could take all of your experience and boil it down to one nugget of advice for maybe another filmmaker or someone in the industry or somebody who's trying to get their start, what would it be?
Do the work. Do the work is what I tell myself. It's like, it's really simple. I tend to overthink things and whatever else, but if you just sit down and do the work, like, and you have, like, your heart is... You're clear in your heart, you know? Clear minds, strong hearts.
Yeah, Friday Night Lights.
Just do the work. We tend to like try to complicate it, but that's pretty much it.
Do the work.
Awesome.
I didn't get to talk at all about my new film. I should mention.
Tell us. Yeah, what are you working on?
Yeah, well, we also ask like if people want to find more out more about you. So talk about what you're working on now, and you know if. Gather has a website or anything like that.
Gatherfilms.net. Shot and we just closed our distribution deal on our most recent film, which is called Goodbye World. It is a apocalyptic big chill, basically. It's a group of friends who come together at a remote cabin in Northern California, off-the-grid house, as civilization is collapsing around them. But we're with these friends, and they're resolving the sort of mini-apocalypses of their own relationships that have developed over the past decade since they've been out of college. It's Adrian Grenier, Scott Miscuddy, who's Kid Cudi, Ben McKenzie, Mark Weber, Gabby Hoffman, Carrie Bechet, and Caroline DeVernis are the seven friends.
Awesome.
They're all great actors, and... So it's a bit of a comedy, but in the way that Big Chill is, in the sense that, like, it's mostly a drama, but it's funny and it's weird, and there's like this apocalyptic angle to it that's like on the outskirts, and it's always sort of like it's the way people would act, I think, if the apocalypse was really going on and you weren't in the middle of it, which is the way we act every day. Like, there's an apocalypse going on right now at this moment in Syria. When this actually airs, there'll be an apocalypse going on somewhere else. For somebody, there's an apocalypse going on a mile away. Like, their world is ending. And, like, we ignore that shit every day. And we go about and we talk about movies and whatever we're talking about. And, like, that's what people would do. And that's what these people do. They're away from it, and they're dealing with their own stuff. And then it starts to kind of creep in at the edges. And as the movie goes on, you know, it's those moments between when the apocalypse happens, some sort of civilization collapsing event, and what happens later when we decide whether or not we can get along as a community. And so we just closed distribution. It'll be coming out. Samuel Goldwyn is putting it out along with Phase 4. It'll be one of those day and date releases where it's in theaters and on VOD and iTunes at the same time.
Awesome.
And that'll be in early 2014. So check it out. It's called Goodbye World. If you're a fan of, you know, Entourage, you get to see Adrian Grenier in a movie. Carrie Bechet is great. Ben McKenzie is great. Scott Muscutty, who you may know as Kid Cudi, the hip-hop artist. Mm-hmm. He was on How to Make It in America, the TV show. And this was his first feature. He's since done a number of them. He's in a big studio film called Need for Speed with Aaron Paul. That'll be coming out next year.
Awesome.
He's amazing. He's so good to work with, such a great actor. So that is the most recent thing that we did, and that was pretty cool.
Oh man, now I have a whole new slew of questions. That is great. Did you want to have him back when the film? I would love that. That'd be great to kind of get your take on what it was like to have that.
Be fun to talk about acting. We didn't get a chance to talk much about acting this time, but like it's been interesting working with that ensemble. Was fun.
I bet. It's a lot of great actors there.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to plan on that.
Cool.
Yeah. So if people want to find out more about you specifically, where can they go? I mean, we'll link to your IMDb profile, but, Facebooks and Twitters and all that stuff?
I don't know. If you're going to spend any time online, if you're at all intrigued by this conversation, I would go watch Bold Native at boldnative.com.
All right.
Give it an hour and a half of your time and see what you think.
I can't wait to check it out. I had no idea it was available online, so I'm going to check that out very soon. And we'll link to that on our site, too. So anybody listening who wants to check it out, if you forgot, boldnative.com, go to our site, click on the link. Dennis, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us, for inviting us into your home, and looking forward to chatting with you very soon.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Hopefully you enjoyed part two, our chat with Dennis. I feel like he's one of those guys where we might actually have him back later on, you know, when he does another project, because he's like constantly working, and he's constantly working with people who are right in our like wheelhouse as far as like you were saying, actor filmmakers or actors who will, you know, do an indie project because it's something they really believe in, and then go back to, you know, doing doing bigger feature films or television. And you know, he even offered, nicest guy in the world, to introduce us to a couple of actors that we have been wanting to have on the podcast. So I have this sense that he's got a lot more to say. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the place of integrity that he comes from with respect to what he is doing and the impact he's having as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not just making some, you know, stupid thing about, I'm just pulling something out of the air here, but like Janet Dickinson Modeling Agency, like that show. Have you ever seen that show?
No.
I had a roommate years ago who used to watch it, and it's like the trashiest crap you could ever imagine putting out into the world. It is like such total shit. And I get angry when I see it on TV, because I'm like, this exists and it's doing nothing but like bring us all down to the lowest fucking common denominator of humanity. Oh, and it's on TV, yes. And people are watching it. And it's just, what is that doing for our culture? What is that doing for humanity except making us petty, stupid, small, obnoxious creatures? So I know that was a little bit of a tirade, but like I bring it up because you've got people like Dennis on the other side of the spectrum who realize the power that they have when they go out and create something, because people like him are creating culture. If you write music, if you paint, if you write books, if you are a filmmaker, if you're an actor, you are creating culture. I think that is what is transmitted way more than, like, you know, if you're a cook even, or I guess even politicians, but like a lot of that's transferred way more than maybe, you know, your job at an insurance firm, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, or the technical manual you're writing for that piece of software that came out that helps you total your, you know, account balances. I don't know what it is, but like the artistic stuff is so heavily important, and that is the legacy of humanity, as it were. Mm-hmm. I think, I know I'm sounding a little probably inappropriately epic here, but I think it's a big deal. And I just love talking to him and hearing that, you know, he's using that very consciously, and that's always been his intention from day one. And he's not self-righteous about it, but he knows what he's doing, and mm-hmm. he takes it seriously. And he's not in it just to make a buck. He wants to say something. And I love it. I love sitting down with him, and I love that that's how he's doing it. You know, that's how he's rolling.
I remember having a very similar tirade when you and I and the Los Angeles Theater Ensemble were trying to get Wounded made into a film. And just seeing the things that were coming out, like if it was something even remotely stupid, I would just get so angry. I'm like, who greenlit this? And why can't we make our film? Like, come on. Anyway, just empathizing. Yeah. Don't worry about going off on your tirades.
Cool.
Totally true.
Cool.
Pick of the week.
Pick of the week. I got one. You got one?
I do.
You want me to go first?
I guess I'll go first. You're throwing it back to me. That's
fine. I can go first.
Oh, it's
no,
fine.
I want to go
no,
first.
It's fine. No, it's no, really, no.
I'm going first. Ready? One, two, three. Writing
Black
Books.
Damn it. Well, okay. You counted the three, so that was kind
okay.
of fair. But
all right. Well, I'll just go ahead. So I got an email from Faye Wolf, who was one of our favorite interviews from, I don't know, just a few episodes ago, not too mm-hmm. long ago. And she's also a personal organizer, as we all know. And the email that she sent out most recently this week had a bunch of like little tools that you could use to help make your email more manageable
what?
In your life. And it was some things I'd heard of before, like unroll.me, which is like a mass unsubscription service from like junk mail and stuff like that. But there were a couple that I hadn't heard of. And one of them's called, I think it's for Gmail only, but it's called Write Inbox. And it's just a simple little tool that allows you to schedule emails. And as I've kind of been practicing these different kind of self-management principles when it comes to my work and my email and my mental health, as it were, I've really been batching a lot of tasks. I've been batching things to, like, I'll make sure that, like, okay, I'm not looking at my phone or my email except at these times that I, like, designate at the beginning of the day. And that way I'm not like going crazy with things beeping at me and vibrating and whatnot. I just turn everything off and then I check my email from like 3 to 4 and I handle all my email then. But a lot of times I want to respond to something, but I don't want to respond to it until like Thursday, or I want to send it out, but I don't want to send it just now, or I want to make sure that they received it. So I'd love to have some sort of read receipt or something like that. So that's what Write Inbox allows you to do. It allows you to kind of write messages and then queue them to be sent at a certain time. And you can also get like a confirmation kicked back to you when the recipient opens the email. And there's a free version that I think allows you to do 10 of those a month. And then there's different plans above that, but they start at like $5 a month. And I think it's really valuable, especially for creative types who are people like our audience who are, a lot of them are doing their own projects and, you know, bouncing emails back and forth between producers and DPs and other actors. And it's just a great tool to have to just kind of like handle it all and then be able to breathe for the next 24 hours, knowing that things are going out when they need to go out and you'll get a confirmation they were received if you need it.
Nice.
So pretty yeah. sweet little thing, writeinbox.com.
I'm going to be spending the next week and a half or so getting into systems. So studying GTD, looking at the software things, looking at Evernote, things like that. And I'm really excited about that. And this sounds right in that vein in terms of like self-productivity. Is that what it's called? Self-productivity?
Self.
Or just productivity period?
Sure.
But yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Your pick of the week. Sweet, dude. My pick of the week is a British television show starring an Irish comedian. How about that? It's called Black Books. It is available on Netflix, and it stars this comedian named Dylan Moran, who I actually went and saw live.
Yeah, you guys just saw him a couple days ago.
It was Monday, I think. I mean, we went to see him because he's hilarious and awesome. He was sick, unfortunately, with this thing that's going around that I think Trevor has.
Great.
And I had. But his brand of comedy, it's very similar to Eddie Izzard, except he's much more pissed off. He's way angrier at the world.
He's an angry, angry chap.
He's an angry Irishman, angry drunk Irishman, and the show is just him being himself in, you know, a sitcom type situation. He owns and manages his own bookstore, and it is laugh out loud funny, especially if you like, you know, British comedy, which can be simultaneous. I've discovered that the thing about British comedy is it can be simultaneously completely outlandish, just out like insane stuff that would never happen in real life, and then also really, really subtle to where you will tend to miss jokes sometimes if you're laughing out loud too much of the previous one, because stuff is so like subtle and intricate. And I think the closest thing we have to anything like that was probably Arrested Development, because of how intricately they weave together the jokes and the running jokes and the callbacks throughout those three seasons and now four seasons. It's probably the closest thing that we have, that's American, I think, in terms of the intelligence of the comedy. And that's including comedies that were born over there and then remade here, like The Office and such. Like, I really do feel like the sort of intellect of Arrested Development is probably the closest we have to the insanity, because it's both outlandish and also, you know, really subtle.
Am I imagining this, or was Arrested Development a remake of something else that came from overseas?
I don't think, I don't know that for sure. I'd have to like look up their wiki, but
okay. I probably am. I know The Office was, and I feel like Arrested Development was too, but I think I also might be getting it confused with the whole thing where it went off the air and then Netflix brought it back
for just one season. Yeah.
It was apparently very different. I don't watch the show, but well, it had been the Netflix
it
version.
It had been
was,
so many years since it went off the air that it had to be different. Right. Michael Cera was like, he was an adult. Right. He was like, he couldn't drink legally when the show went off the air, and he could when it came back. I mean, you know, there was some time had passed, so it had no choice but to be different. Uh-huh. So
okay.
Anyway, but we also have, so that's it, Black Books. And then we also have our listener pick.
Yeah. Listener pick. This comes from Matt, the guy we talked about a little bit earlier, who wrote us just a really wonderful email that I might read every day for the rest of my life. just to make me realize that life is beautiful. But he sent us a couple, but the one that stood out to me to mention on this episode is called Unscripted, and it's about, looks like it was made in 2005, and it's about three actors that take an acting class and then are trying to make it big in Hollywood. And I'm just kind of looking at the IMDb page here, and it just looks like it's a funny movie. HBO, I guess, is where it kind of originated. And
is it a movie or a TV show? I thought he sent us three TV shows.
Oh, is it a TV show?
I don't know. I could be totally wrong.
Wow. We're really kind of messing this one up, aren't we?
Is there a rating on it?
6.5.
No, I mean like RGPG, because there's no rating. It might be a...
Oh, it might be a TV show, because it does say 2005, and then it has a little dash, and there's a blank after the dash. So maybe that means it's still... Yes, it is a TV show. Yes. And it looks like it only had 10 episodes, or at least the cast credited here are all only cast or credited for 10 episodes. Anyway, he says it's really great. It looks funny. And it looks like it's also on Amazon Prime. So if you are a member of that, you could probably stream it or download it or something.
Boom Goes the Dynamite.
Yeah. But Matt says it's great. So we'll put a link on the website. Y'all check it out. Does that do it?
I think that's it.
For episode 119? All right. Cool. Well, then, there it is. Episode 119. Lots of different ways for you, the listener, to interact with and be a part of the podcast. You can start by going to our website, insideactingpodcast.com, and if you feel so inclined, leaving a comment on one of the episode posts, and or emailing us at insideactingpodcast@gmail.com, and or leaving us a voicemail at 213-2-ACTORS. That's 213-222-8677. And in all of those instances, we'll probably put your comments on the show and talk about it if you like. Not like a requirement or anything, but you know. How else can they get in touch with us?
Well, we're all over the internet, so just search for Inside Acting on any number of social media sites, or you know, like Twitter and Facebook, or iTunes and Actor Rated, where you can leave us a 5-star review. Or get in touch with us if it's not going to be a 5-star review.
Right.
Let us know why not, so we can fix it. And, of course, there's always the donation opportunity that you have on our website. The opportunity to be a part of this financially, be a part of supporting the podcast and continuing financially, because, you know, we're doing this all out of pocket, so we're spending a lot of time, money, and effort on the podcast. Production itself, not to mention the fact that we've got a team growing now with people who are also working pro bono, and equipment, which I'm not even going to mention because we pretty much mention it every time we talk about the donations, but you understand what's happening over here.
Yeah.
So head on over to the website, insideactingpodcast.com. There's a donate button. You can either sign up for a recurring donation, in which case you become a patron of the podcast and you get your picture and little blurb on our patron page on our website, or you can just do a one-time donation of $1 billion and you're set for karma for life.
That's right. And we definitely want to acknowledge all the wonderful people we have doing that right now. Our patrons, we've got about a dozen of them, and they really keep the wheels going round on this thing. So thank you, you guys. You know who you are, and if anybody else is curious, head over to our patron page and have a look at their beautiful faces and
there
see what
is.
They're up to. Then that really is it, isn't it?
I think so.
Cool. So for our production coordinator, Jen Levin, for our technical producer, Cesar Carminio, I love saying his name, and for myself, Trevor Helgott.
I'm AJ Meyer. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, back to my Texas.